Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The Great Flood of 1993 is still a very vivid memory for those who saw the high water and its impact on much of the Midwest. In our region, homes, businesses, fields, and other property were claimed by the 500-year flood that began in the spring and lasted into the early fall. Who can forget the flooded Chesterfield Valley, dangerous floating propane tanks in South St. Louis, watching an East Side home being swept away live on TV after a disastrous levee break, and so much more, scenes of water where it had never been before. At this point in the summer of 93, the waters were just beginning to recede, too late for so many. I'm Don Marsh. We'll look back on the Great Flood on today's program and ask you for your most vivid memory of that flood. With me in studio is Mary DeLocke Leonard of the St. Louis Beacon. She has been writing about the flood for most of this summer. Mary, so nice to see you.
Hi, Don.
We're asking people for their most vivid memory. What's yours?
Taking my daughters, who were young at the time, to the steps of the Gateway Arch to see the flood, which, you know, peaked at, what was it, 49.6 feet, something like
right.
19 feet above
yeah,
the flood level,
yeah.
and taking them onto the grand stairway and just saying to them, look here, you'll never see this again in your lifetime, I hope. and you'll be telling your grandchildren about this because, you know, as you know, we'd never seen water like that coming up that far on the stairway, the grand stairway. And, you know, to this day, there are the bronze plaques where you can go and stand and say, well, this is how high the water went.
You know, you said something in our famous green room before we started this conversation about young people today who weren't alive. They have no idea what this river can do and the kind of damage, unless they've seen the photographs or maybe some old video, no idea what it was like.
That's true. When I was out working on these anniversary pieces, if you think about it, if you weren't at least 5 or 6 years old, and even if you were just 5 or 6, you probably have very dim memories. So we have basically a generation now of St. Louisans who really don't know how bad that was. I mean, we've seen flooding just about every spring. We see flooding. And this past spring, you know, there was some substantial flooding. But everyone now compares it to 93. So even when the Mississippi River gets up to, you know, the fifth or sixth highest crest, a lot of people sort of look at it and go, well, I don't know. How does it compare to 93?
Mm-hmm. Well, nothing compares, obviously, to 93. You know, there's so many different ways, Mary, you could have gone in writing your Beacon pieces on the flood. But you pretty much focused on the Illinois community of Valmire and, of course, our famous Chesterfield Valley. Why did you take that approach?
Because basically when you look at communities in our region, these two communities were very different communities in terms of their size and where they were, what they were made up of. But they were very similar in that they were in floodplains. And after the flooding, they took two totally different approaches to what are we going to do now? Valmire moved, picked up the whole community and moved up the bluffs. Chesterfield, as we know, you know, the former Gumbo Flats is now one of the largest major business retail complexes in the region. You know, it's a driving force. It brings in tons of money in terms of sales tax and revenue for St. Louis County. It's just totally different in terms of what they did.
You know, until I read your pieces, I had forgotten that it was once called Gumbo Flats. Now it's Chesterfield Valley.
Right.
You know, we have what we call a montage of recollections of people who lived through all of that. Let's take a listen to some of the thoughts that people had about that flood.
A lot of people didn't get out with anything, and when you have kids, you got to try to grab something. So,
what did you get?
Everybody got a little bit of clothing and the essentials. I don't know if we got toothpaste or toothbrushes, but we got something, I'm sure. We're waiting to find out here what's going on and how long it may be. We don't know.
We have advised people down there, even the holdouts, that it's time to get out. We got some folks who just as soon have a beer and catch catfish because the catfish fishing is supposedly great when the river is up, and it is.
We had a 500-gallon tank, three quarters full of diesel fuel, break loose and start its way through town last week, and if I'm here, I may not be able to pull it away, but if I see it coming, I can tow onto it, at least steer it past my house and hope it doesn't hit anybody else's if I can't anchor it. things like that. You never know what's coming down the river.
Wait till it goes down and just sit and think of all the hard work that's ahead of us.
And I think that if any of them watched the news, and I don't know which channel it was on, when the Quincy, Illinois levee broke, and see a wall of water coming across a field crash into a barn and there's no more barn. If they seen that, I don't know how they can sit there in those little tin can mobile homes and say, it's going to protect me. It won't. It'll fold it up like an accordion.
I guess the best way I can summarize it, I'm not one damn bit scared of that river, but I've got a lot of respect for it because it's not going to give you a second chance.
All right. Well, there are some of the thoughts of people remembering the Great Flood of 93. In just a couple of moments, we're going to be talking with a representative from the Army Corps of Engineers. So engineers who obviously play a big role. They played a big role then, and they play a big role in the management of the river. But, you know, these 500-year floods doesn't necessarily mean that you have to wait 500 years for the next one, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't. And I think it's striking that most of the folks that I've talked to in working on these stories, whether they're involved with engineering or environmentalists or the business folks or the city officials, will all tell you those levees are not indestructible. And they use this, I've heard this several times from several folks, it's not a matter of if that levee goes, it's a matter of when it goes. But it could be 10 years, 20 years, it could be 500 years.
And yet we look out at Chesterfield Valley and see what's been done there since it was Gumbo Flats.
Well, they've built quite a levee there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll be talking about that shortly. But, I mean, that is, it's very, in terms of levee building, it's very impressive what they've done there in terms of the design, the engineering. I think also what's very impressive there to me is that the Monarch Levee there has become part of the fabric of life in that valley. That it's become a recreational area. It's pretty amazing, really. People, I think, particularly people who are younger, probably don't even realize on a day-to-day basis, and I had people tell me that when I was doing interviews for the story, that they don't think about the levee as being protecting them from the river. They just, it's just there.
Just there. Let's hope that that it stays there. Were there any surprises that you found in doing your work on these stories?
What I found surprising, I think, was the reaction of a lot of the people in the communities, and I'm not talking about the officials. But what I'm talking about is there seemed to be more attention being paid to this 20th anniversary by the media than there were by residents. And I think what that told me, and just the sense I've got from speaking to a lot of people, was they've moved on. At 10 years, even at 10 years, the anniversary, people were still rebuilding. They were still dealing with the aftermath. But 20 years later, you know, Valmeyer's up on the bluffs, and, you know, the development continues in Chesterfield, people have moved on. And some of them really just don't want to talk about it anymore, and particularly people who suffered a lot of damage. I think they're tired of talking about it.
And one thing we ought to point out here is the fact that St. Louis wasn't the only place affected, or this part of Missouri and Illinois.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the numbers of, 50,000 homes across really we're talking about the Missouri River, Mississippi River, but sure. A lot of it was along the Missouri River. And I think sometimes we forget that as well. But, 50,000 homes damaged or destroyed, 50,000 people relocated. I think the acreage was something like 9 million acres underwater.
Billions and billions of dollars in property.
People nationally would look at the flood stories and they thought the entire Midwest was underwater because, you know, you got that sense from looking at these, if you remember the national coverage at in the time. I had people from other parts of the country who would call me and say, how are you doing? Are you doing okay there? Because it was just so widespread.
I had the same thing. We're going to be joined now by a representative from the Army Corps of Engineers. Dave Bussey is Chief of Engineering Construction for the Army Corps. Dave, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I think the thing that people would really like to know from you and yours is how well protected is this region right now from another 500-year flood?
Well, let me start with 1993 wasn't a 500-year flood.
Oh, really?
It's
we've certainly been hearing that it was.
Yeah, and that's a common thing that we hear a lot. But we're calculating, and I don't put a lot of faith in these numbers, but the official estimate is that 300 year was 1993. And how are we set here in the St. Louis region for another 93 event?
Mm-hmm.
We know some of our levee systems are much stronger than they were. You just discussed Chesterfield. It's a much wider levee than it used to be and taller. St. Louis flood wall has had major repairs to it since 1993. It's a much better flood wall slash levee than it used to be. We've had major repairs on Wood River and some on Metro East and others. So we're in much better shape than we were in 1993. One of the best things we have going for us now that we didn't have going for us in 93 is we've been through it. We understand where the weaknesses are, and we've been addressing those. When you have a large flood like we did in 1993 that was 6 feet over the previous largest event, it really shows the areas that need to be addressed. And on the Metro East side, they've been raising taxes and trying to make those repairs. And there's been repairs made, but there's more to be done.
So what you're saying, Dave, I'm sure, is that if we had another 1993 event, whatever, however we want to characterize it, the Monarch levee would probably hold.
That would be our estimation right now. But the thing that everybody has to realize, there are no perfect levees, and they're made out of dirt and clay, and they're topped with grass. So there are no guarantees in life. And we don't necessarily provide flood protection as much as flood risk management. There are no perfect levees. So while we think those levees will hold, and I have a great deal of confidence they will for another 93, there are no guarantees.
What do you think when you look at Chesterfield Valley now and see what's gone on there since 93? I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent to build the malls and what have you. What do you think when you see that?
I see what you were talking about before is different communities taking different actions based on 93 flood. These are public policy decisions and not necessarily Corps of Engineers decisions. But you have one, Chesterfield, decided to build their protection stronger. You've had Valmire move out. And then you had somewhere in between that you haven't discussed is someplace like Grafton, which has embraced living near the river, but have moved most of the houses up on the hill. Mm-hmm. But they leave their businesses that are critical to ecotourism and those kinds of things. I think it's those kinds of decisions. It's fascinating to me to see how different people take different actions based on the same event.
Well, and the two communities of Valmire and Chesterfield were very different in that respect as well. The entire community of Valmire was underwater, and that was everything. Whereas in Chesterfield, most of the residences were up high and were not underwater, so it was primarily affected there with businesses. So as the current mayor of Valmire pointed out to me, just what this gentleman just said, each community has to decide for itself what's best for us.
Dave, I just have one other question for you. I remember covering the floods still very vividly, and one of the things I kept hearing over and over again, particularly from people downriver, was the fact that these, as they would say, these darn levees, you know, this is the cause of the problem, that they just let the river go where it would normally go, you know, we wouldn't have as significant a problem as we've had. How do you answer that?
Yeah, it depends on what you look at as the flooding problem. And they are public policy types of things. But the example I would give is 1993 was an extremely large event, and it was caused by rain, not by levees. However, 1903 was a huge event, calculated around 1 million CFS. It came in much lower than 1993 because there were no levees. However, what you did have in this area was flooding all across East St. Louis and Wood River and went all the way to the bluffs of Collinsville. And there were hundreds and thousands of people with no shelter, no place to live. People couldn't get food. So was it as high? No, not in 1903, but it was all within the levees. In 1903, it was lower, but it flooded the entire floodplain. So people make choices on what they would prefer. And in this area, people have preferred to live and build in the floodplain.
Well, we hope we don't have a 1903 or a 1993 again in our lifetime, at least, Dave Bussey. Thank you so much for being with us and giving us the benefit of your expertise on these issues. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
That's Dave Bussey, Chief of Engineering and Construction for the Army Corps of Engineers here in St. Louis. We have to take a break now. We'll do that. We'll come back. We'll take some of your calls again. We're asking for your most vivid memory. And we'll be talking to some other people who were in official positions, during 1993. With me in studio is Mary DeLock Leonard of the St. Louis Beacon. She's been writing for most of the summer on flooding stories, looking back at 1993. We'll be back in a second. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. Before we continue our conversation and retrospective on the Great Flood of 1993 with Mary DeLock Leonard here in studio and others, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri's Attorney General held a press conference announcing legal action against Walgreens for, quote, false, misleading, and deceptive pricing schemes. The St. Louis County Council meets tonight and is expected to make a final decision about a senior living facility under construction in Oakville. And our State House reporter Marshall Griffin is working on a story about new Missouri laws, which will be taking effect tomorrow. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. I'm going to go to the phones now, Mary. Anything that occurred to you during that break that you want to mention before we do so?
It's always interesting to hear the Corps' point of view, and we're not really talking as much today about the environmental point of view, but they're very different points of view, and I think that's something that when we and the term flood risk, floodplain risk management is very important, and I think that's what has been crucial in terms of the policymaking. Again, it's two different points of view over what's the best thing to do.
Sure. Were you surprised that he doesn't call it a 500-year flood?
You know, I've heard this before, but yeah. I think that it's so difficult to wrap your head around. But basically, in Chesterfield, the Monarch Levee is up to 500 level, but what does that really mean to people?
Yeah, it's really doesn't make any difference. So once it happens, when it happens, what you call it. Let's take a couple of calls. I want to encourage folks in the audience to be with us on this. We want your memories, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. But let's go to Justin calling from St. Louis. He's been waiting since the outset of the program. Justin, thanks for being so patient. Go ahead.
Thanks for having this wonderful topic. This is just a really wonderful emotional memory for me. I was reflectively a very self-absorbed teenager, as I think most of us were, and I hung with many groups of friends. One of them was so self-absorbed they didn't have any problem with stealing cars to joyride at 14, 15 years old. And yet every single child I knew, myself included, even though I had a broken leg and a walking cast, insisted. And there were groups of people organized through friends of friends who knew somebody whose house was about to be flooded. And everyone I knew, every available hour or weekend, was going to sandbag somewhere. And, you know, my father advocated for me to be able to go when I was told I couldn't because of the cast. They wouldn't take me on the group. And he strapped a trash bag around my cast and said, I can, you know, I'm a doctor. I can put that cast back on a lot quicker than they can rebuild their house. And while we're down there alongside these people's houses, somebody hands me what I thought was a can of beer, and I said, no, thank you. And when they said, no, you need this, you're thirsty, I looked back at it, and it was that Budweiser white can with just water printed on it. Come to find out, Anheuser-Busch had stopped printing, or had stopped a line of production of beer just to make canned water to send out to everyone who needed it. And just an amazing time in St. Louis to see just the outpouring from every single person just poured out of the woodwork to help and to fight, you know, to save our homes.
Justin, thanks for helping us remember that. I'd forgotten about those famous white cans, but they certainly were all
one.
Over there. Do you really?
I do. I had forgotten. But,
The Anheuser-Busch, when there's ever a tragedy of this scope, is always there with those white cans and water. They've done a great job with that.
And, you know, I think he speaks to what I think is one of the remarkable aspects of the St. Louis area. On a daily basis, we tend to forget that we even live near rivers. Part of it is because many of us live inland. Part of it is because of the levees. But whenever in the spring they start announcing that there's some issues, maybe it's Grafton or maybe it's even further north, Hannibal or whatever, the outpouring, when they put that call out for sandbaggers, hundreds of people show up. And that's pretty remarkable.
It was absolutely remarkable. And one of the things that stands out in my mind was the town of Prairie du Rocher in Illinois, which was very, very close to being inundated. And if it weren't for the sandbaggers there, it would have been. But it was so touch and go at Prairie du Rocher, as I recall, that they asked the TV news helicopters to not fly in the area because it was so close to going over those sandbags as they were still putting them down that the wash from the helicopter blades might have breached that caused a breach in the sandbags. It's incredible, and yet they were the folks that were doing the sandbagging were at risk if that had happened. Needless to say,
absolutely.
I'm going to bring in Don calling from St. Louis too. He's going to bring up a subject that I think many of us will remember. Go ahead, Don. Don, you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
I wanted to say I was a lot more fortunate than most people were at that time. I was evacuated from South St. Louis County, not because of the water danger, but because of the floating propane tanks. They were threatening that they may explode. And so I got word early, a little early, that the National Guard was coming around and telling people to leave. I had about 20 minutes, and I put just about everything. I put everything that was really important to me in my car, and I drove to a friend's house and stayed there. And as I was leaving my driveway, I thought, you know what, if I don't ever get to come back here, I have what few possessions are really meaningful to me, family photographs and letters and so forth. And I let go of a lot of the need to have a lot of stuff and have been a lot more content. It was a life lesson for me to just live simply.
Don, good story. Do you remember those floating propane tanks, Mary?
I remember the images. That was frightening. The coffins floating up on the Missouri River at different places. Absolutely astonishing.
Dead and bloated animals floating down
absolutely.
The river. Those propane tanks, I remember someone saying at the time that if they had blown, and even though it was on this side of the river, that it probably would have wiped out the entire community of Dupo. That's how potentially dangerous they were. But they were ultimately corralled, and my God, what a tragedy that could have been. And it certainly would have done a lot of damage on this side of the river as well, but even across the river.
It does speak to the danger that was averted. I mean, there was a lot of damage, but when you think about exactly what you're saying, the danger that was averted is pretty amazing.
It was not only the question of the sandbaggers and the job they did, but emergency responders and the people that we kind of take for granted, they did a heck of a job too. I'm going to take one more call here that'll bring us to our next call-in guest. Richard in St. Louis, go ahead and I'll put you on the air.
My comment is that the area out there in Chesterfield when I was growing up was all farmland. It was called gumbo when I was a child. We used to go out there on Sundays and go to the farmers out there and buy vegetables and eggs, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that is known. It's called gumbo because the river overflowed out there every year and brought all the nutrient-rich, quote, gumbo out there, which was that nasty, gooey black stuff that made the farmland so rich. And now all the subdivisions and businesses and malls have all built out there, and we're supposed to feel sorry for them because it floods out there. It's known to flood. It's a floodplain. It's floodland. And now when they get flooded out, the insurance companies have to reimburse them for all their damage, and my insurance rates go up because these people shouldn't have been allowed to build out there in the first place, and that's my comment.
Richard, thank you so much for that comment. Now, in conjunction with that particular real estate, let's bring in Captain Ed Nestor of the Chesterfield Police Department. He was, by the way, the spokesperson dealing with the media during the flood. Captain, you with us?
Yes, I am, Don.
Well, did you know that that's how gumbo got its name?
I didn't know that, no, sir.
See, you learn something every day when you listen to NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. Captain, what is your most vivid memory of that time?
Oh boy, there's so many. You know, I guess probably the what we refer to as the boat dock, which was Highway 40, Interstate 64. You know, where the water came up to a certain point, and you know, and that was it. The road just ended in the water, and you know, as you know, they, we had all the businesses that were affected out there, and they had to go in and try to salvage some of their important things, and so. You know, we were out there. I mean, it was just unbelievable, just lines of people waiting to get in boats and go out, and we had to have a pass system. And I guess that whole memory of being out there on those long days.
I have an acquaintance who had a business out there and told the story of going out in a boat to climb in the second-story window of his place and stepping into a mass of snakes who had all sought refuge in his building. I guess you've heard stories like that before.
Yeah, lots of different stories. There were just, you know, so many things going on there. I know our own police department, you know, we had 12 feet of water in there. And, you know, we actually went into the, because it was a higher building than that, we actually went in there because the doors had blown out the back in a boat. And I was right above my desk, you know, under 12 feet of water. And some stuff was just completely gone. And the pens were all still in the pen, you know, in the holder on the desk and with, you know, mud in there and stuff. It's just, it was surreal.
Well, what sort of thoughts go through your mind when you look over the valley now and see the building that's gone on since the flood of 93?
Yeah, it's just amazing. It's mind-boggling. I mean, I think, you know, thinking as policemen do, we pretty much thought that area was done and wasn't going to come back because we're not developers. We're not the kind of people that, you know, make money. So, you know, those thoughts didn't even really cross my mind. It was just, you know, how are we going to recover from this, and how, what's our mission going to be like going forward?
You know, we talked with a representative from the Corps of Engineers a little while ago, and no one can say definitively that this couldn't happen again, even with the reconstructed Monarch Levee.
Yeah, well, those are, you know, those are areas that aren't in my my realm of expertise, but, you know, certainly hope not. But, again, you know, we police whatever's there before us.
You know, you bring up a point about the flood water. I think if people who have never been in a situation of flooding, they have no idea just what flood water really is and how awful it is and how absolutely disgusting it is and the dangers involved in it. You know, when you stand back from afar and you see the photographs or you see the images, you really don't realize what that is. It's such a concoction of, it's a stew of just awful things.
It's a gumbo.
It's a gumbo, yes.
Yeah, I remember very distinctly, you know, there was a rescue out there, which I wasn't involved in, but one of our officers was with the Highway Patrol. And there was a guy who was clinging on to a signpost right there at Long Road and the Chesterfield Airport Road, and they rescued him, pulled him up on the skin of a helicopter and took him out of there. But I remember all the things that we saw floating down there, and I know we all received, they had like a medical station set up, and they made us all get shots before we were working around the water there because, you know, you certainly came in contact with that stuff, and it was not pretty-looking water, that's for sure.
There's one other point that I think gets forgotten in terms of Chesterfield. The community had just incorporated in 1988. So this community was 5 years old when this flood hit. And I think it's, when you think back to that time, it must be pretty remarkable for yourself to even imagine what you all were able to do in terms of your public safety efforts and the work that you did for your residents and business owners.
Yeah, it was a really you know, amazing time, and even though it was a tragedy, it brought a lot of people together. The St. Louis Family Church, which is pretty well known now because of all their work they do with Service International that they formed at that time, was just a small gathering of people that we really, I don't think I even knew they existed, and they were out there helping those affected, and they were serving food to all the public safety workers and the volunteers, and it just helped, I think, build a sense of community. And you know, when the valley started, people were like, "We're going to make this come back," and everybody got together. You know, some of that is still there. Some of those feelings are still there. As a matter of fact, I think the city's going to have at one of their free concerts coming up. They're going to have all the businesses that went back and stayed in the Valley. They're having them up as guests, going to have a reception for them with the anniversary coming.
You, Captain, were, of course, a press spokesman at the time. What about media coverage of the flood? What are your thoughts and recollections about that?
Yeah, it was nonstop. I had never dealt with anything like that. You know, we had a number of relatively large-sized stories, but to have the national media there, as I recall, looking back, it was just an endless stream. I mean, we'd do about an hour's worth of interviews. Everybody would get in a line, and then I'd go take about a 15-minute break in the trailer down there and then come back out and just start over because, you know, we were the last levee to break, so there was already a lot of national media in the area, and everybody... You know, everybody was watching this. They were just shocked because they're familiar with the area and they're not used to seeing the water over the highway. Everybody wanted to come out and see it. But for a couple of years, people would walk up to me when I was out of the grocery store or whatever and say, hey, you're the flood guy. So,
One of the things I remember is some of the television news people and their waders up to their chest standing in the floodwater telling people not to go near the floodwater.
Yeah, that's true.
That's television for you.
Absolutely.
Captain Ed Nestor, thanks so much for being with us and help us with this retrospective on the flood of 93. Great talking to you, and keep up the good work out there in Chesterfield.
My pleasure. Thanks, Don.
Yep. Captain Ed Nestor of the Chesterfield Police Department. He was the media spokesperson for the media. He was a spokesperson for the Chesterfield Police Department serving the media in the flood of 93. I've got to take another break. We'll do that now. Come back and take more of your calls, more of your recollections. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our retrospective on the Great Flood of 1993. With me in studio is Mary DeLock Leonard of St. Louis Beacon. She's been writing pieces on the flood 20 years later during the course of the summer for the Beacon. Mary, you just came up with it off the air, some interesting figures that reflect what's gone on out in Chesterfield.
Right. When in 93, there were 240 businesses in the valley. I think something like 80 of them did not come back, but the others came back. And if you do a count now, it's like 900 businesses there. So that's the amount of growth that we've seen. The valley then was a lot different place than the valley now, as one of the callers pointed out.
That obviously they have a lot of faith and have done a lot of due diligence, and they're convinced that it's the right thing to do.
There are also a lot of people out there with flood insurance. I will point this out, too. I have some statistics on that. Something like 120 residences in Chesterfield have flood insurance, $31 million worth of coverage, and 258 businesses have flood insurance, $131 million worth of coverage. So people are... They do have flood insurance.
They do have a sense that, you know, it could happen again. You know, before we bring in our next guest talking about Valmeyer, we mentioned it early on, 20 years ago, NPR was all over the flood story, as most media were. And we have a clip here of one of the reports dealing with Valmeyer during this particular episode during the flood. Let's listen to that now.
In Valmeyer, Illinois, about 60 miles south of St. Louis, almost every home and building was inundated. Now the village of 900 faces some difficult choices that will determine if Valmeyer will ever exist again. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The village of Valmeyer, Illinois, is barely alive. It was a small town 3 miles from the Mississippi, but ever since a wall of water engulfed a farm levee north of Valmeyer, the river runs right through the town and the small lake where people used to go fishing. The force of the river is apparent. Only 4 of 350 houses and buildings didn't get water on the first floor. Some still sit in water. The river raised right up to the rooftops of many homes. Except for the National Guard, the town's fire and police chiefs, and a couple of village employees, the place is a swampy ghost town. The old stone city hall right by the railroad tracks took on more than 8 feet of water. Mayor Dennis Knubluck worries about all the damage, but what strikes him most on a trip back to the building is the silent clock that stopped 1 month ago today.
You can see all the clocks are stopped at the bewitching time of 1:20. That's when I gave the signal to the power company to go ahead and shut the power off in town, when we knew that there definitely was a levee break and the water was going to be coming. So that's when the town went black.
The mayor says it's been hard on everyone.
You know, these people have been put out of their homes. A lot of them are in temporary shelters. A lot of them have no idea where their belongings are, and their families are split apart, and they're looking for some type of order in their life, and they can't find it here at this point.
Well, that was a report filed by Kathy Lohr of NPR 20 years ago. Dennis Knobloch is no longer the mayor of Valmire. He's the county clerk of Monroe County, and he joins us now by phone. Dennis, that brought back some memories, I'm sure.
Yes, it sure did. I know I sounded 20 years younger on that clip. That makes me feel good.
Well, it's always good to feel 20 years younger.
I certainly
vouch for that. What is your most vivid recollection, Dennis, of that time?
Well, I think it was just the extent of the flooding that we suffered and the amount of damage that took place. We definitely felt through the entire flood fight that we would not have any problems. We had a Corps of Engineers certified levee that was protecting our area and had done so since 1950. And we all fought hard during the flood fight and did everything we could. But once the water came through, it came through with more force and depth than we ever would have expected and left a lot of damage in its wake.
Give us some sense, if you would, Dennis, of the decision to move.
Well, we started surveying the property immediately after the water started coming in. The first few days, all we could do was get up into the air by helicopter and try to see as much as we possibly could. And then as the water level started going down and the current started backing off a little bit to the point where the Coast Guard felt comfortable taking boats into town, we could even get more of a sense of the damage that had taken place. And early on, within the first 2 to 4 weeks already, it was very evident to us that there was going to be a lot of damage to the homes and the structures there. And we knew that because of that and the drastic nature of the flooding that had taken place, that many of the folks, first of all, wouldn't want to come back. And secondly, even if they did, it would be difficult because of the floodplain regulations to get the necessary permits to rebuild.
I've got another flashback for you here. See if you can remember who this fellow was.
When we get done, we'll have a Valmire that will be similar in shape, form, and size to what we've had before, except it's going to be up the map a little bit. And basically, we'll have the potential for future damage lessened. Everybody's sitting there looking dumbfounded.
I guess they were dumbfounded.
Yes, they were.
But,
well, it was a pretty wild idea at that time. But after a lot of study, we realized that we had two options. We could either make an attempt to move the town, or we could let it just fade away into the pages of history. And that's what would have happened had we not made the decision to relocate to higher ground.
What was the population of the old Valmire, and what's the population of the new?
At the time of the flood, our population was 900. Our population currently is 1,200.
So it has grown. Has the town developed as you had hoped it would?
Well, for the most part, the residential areas have developed as we had planned. The institutional parts of the community, meaning our K-12 school and our churches and things like that, have developed as planned. The one place where we fell short was with our business community. We had about 25 businesses at the time of the flood, and as the period went on, when we were going through the relocation, the folks that lived in town could live in temporary housing and still commute to a job outside the community. The businesses that were shut down because of the flood had a problem because they could not go back into business until the people came back into town. And it was about 2.5 years before the majority of our residents moved back in. So those folks, many of our businesses, either folded and just ceased being a business. several moved to surrounding communities, but the business community was the most drastically affected by the flood.
Mary DeLock Leonard is with me in studio, and she's nodding as you say those words. I'm sure that's a reflection she had as well.
Well, Dennis, we talked about that when we were working on the Beacon coverage, and I thank you very much, by the way. It was wonderful to spend so much time with you and the residents of your town. I think that you also had a point that you made in 93 to Congress about what your community was facing in terms of that timing that you're talking about.
Correct.
And that was one of the big concerns. And from what other folks have told me, it remains one of the biggest concerns. If a community has been devastated, as yours was, and decides that it wants to take such an approach as yours, it takes a long time to get through the government paperwork. And so if you would talk about that for a little bit.
Sure. Well, following the flood, it quickly became evident that there were a lot of communities that had been affected by the flooding in a major way and were looking at some type of recovery. Some communities talked about relocation and trying to do that type of a project with their towns as well. And I quickly learned that the network of folks that were involved with those types of situations, it was helpful to talk with other communities and find out what they were doing and the approach they were taking. So I worked and talked with other communities during that time, and it became evident very quickly that timing was going to be a major problem. And we learned that early on with our own community. The folks were in temporary housing, and it was a situation that was, in most cases, less of a comfortable living situation than they had been in before with their own homes. So they were really not willing to tolerate that any longer than they absolutely had to. And once we started into the process of our relocation, and the most daunting part of it was probably the environmental assessment that we had to do on both the new town area and the previous town. We dealt with more than 25 different local, state, and federal agencies. So you can imagine the mountain of red tape that we had to sort our way through to get to the point that we needed to with the relocation project. And that was the big problem that we had. You know, we first promised the people that we would have them into a home by Christmas of the second Christmas after the flood, which would have been December of 94. And because of all of the setbacks due to all of the government regulations, it was after that before we could get people back into their homes. So in most cases, it's a pretty daunting process for anybody that wants to try to do this.
Well, the whole Valmire story is really quite a story. Dennis Knobloch, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The move was the right thing to do, wasn't it?
As far as I'm concerned, it was the only thing that we could do. And as we look at the situations now that unfold, previously this year when the Mississippi River levels were continuing to rise and a lot of the communities along the river were sandbagging and concerned about the stability of their own communities, that was one thing that we didn't have to worry about.
I want to thank you so much, Dennis, for being with us. Dennis is the county clerk of Monroe County, the former mayor of Valmire, the community that moved because of the flood. Thank you so much for being with us, Dennis.
Thank you, Don.
I want to go back to the phones, Mary, and unless you have something to add, a number of people want to tell their stories.
Well, so I'd like to hear what they have to say.
Let's bring in Jerry from O'Fallon. He's been waiting the longest. Thanks for waiting, Jerry. Go ahead, but make it quick, if you would.
Okay, good morning. I just wanted to remind the first caller that Anheuser-Busch still cans water, but it's called Natural Light. But seriously, a friend of mine owned a restaurant on Main Street in St. Charles and spent the weekend that the gumbo levee failed. And looking back in retrospect, it was really foolish because the main part of the restaurant and bar was in the basement area. And the waters, we were protected by a sandbag levee, was probably 2 feet higher than the ceiling. So had those sandbag levees failed, those of us who were in the basement working with pumps and other just essentially a lot of sump pumps trying to keep the water at least a foot, foot and a half high, would probably not, I would not be here to tell you this story. So I've hopefully gained a little wisdom in that period of time. But I remember it quite vividly. And, of course, the necessity to dip your hands in a bleach water solution before you touched anything, because we have no idea and probably don't want to have any idea what was in a lot of that floodwater. But thank you.
Jerry, thank you for the call. I'm sure Jerry remembers those planes floating out at the airport out there at the Gumbo Flats in the day.
Actually, though, they had moved all of the planes out. Those were just some old relics.
Old relics. Mm-hmm. Well, they were still floating. You don't see floating airplanes.
No, they made great pictures for national TV.
They certainly did. Let's bring in Dave from Afton. Dave, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yeah, I sandbagged down in Festus Crystal City area and then right there in Barnhart by M. But I also was out on the Anheuser State, just south of Kimswick, and the water was starting to come up, and there was an old Catholic summer house. It was for kids to come in. It was huge. I don't know what the square footage was, but the bricks, the inner walls and outer walls were all brick. They were five bricks thick, and it had a central chimney. And it had wraparound porches on three sides, first and second floor, that extended out probably 15, 20 foot. But it had a dirt floor in the basement, and the water came in. And this was kind of north of the main house, the building was. The water came in, and when it left, it actually pulled the chimney down, which just it pulled the roof in. I happened to go up inside it, and the floors were collapsed downward and everything. And in the end, the executor of the estate for Mrs. Anheuser decided that it would have cost $250,000 to put it back in shape. But I think the fire department down there, they went ahead and set it on fire and, you know, worked with putting it out. But the water came up into Mrs. Anheuser's place 3 foot on the first floor, and then the guest cottage that was there, the water came up all the way to the ceiling in there. But the gentleman who was the executor, he took care of both properties, and they're still functioning
well. Dave, thanks for being with us. Of course, that kind of story was repeated many, many times, probably thousands of times during the course of the flood. I'm going to very quickly try to get Elizabeth in, calling from St. Louis County. Elizabeth, go ahead, but make it a very quick comment or question, please.
Okay, I just wondered why businesses in Chesterfield Valley are not required to have flood insurance, as are homeowners who live in floodplains or near floodplains. And I guess that means that the taxpayer will be bailing them out if there's another flood.
Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. What do you think, Mary?
You know, it's a very complicated, flood insurance is very, very complicated, and I couldn't begin to explain this other than to say that if you don't have a mortgage, you don't have to have flood insurance. That's the risk you take. However, you can't build. This is a very protected area. FEMA considers it very protected area. So it's very complicated, but there is a lot of flood insurance out in that valley.
Yeah, the insurance question always gets a lot of attention after an event like this. I only have a few seconds left, and I'm surprised this didn't come up, but one of the great tragedies of the flood of 93 was the incident at Cliff Cave Park, in which four kids and two of their adult supervisors were exploring the caves during the middle of this flood season. God knows who thought that was a good idea, but they perished in those caves because of the high water. Do you remember that?
I remember that, and you know, now that you bring it up, it is a case that has not gotten much attention. Yeah. I think because most of the focus was on the levees and the flood fights for communities, but that was a very tragic.
Yeah,
very tragic case.
I think that was probably one of the most significant events of the flood during a period of time when there were many, many significant events, as we have recounted some of them here today. A final thought, Mary, in 10 seconds, we've got to say goodbye.
20 years.
20 years.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
and whatever we call it, a 300-year flood or a 93 event or a 500-year flood, let's hope for the rest of our days and for many more we don't see that again. Mary DeLocklander, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Great to see you again. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the March on Washington on its 50th anniversary and its effect on civil rights efforts here in St. Louis. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.